summoned through the dimension of sound. People explore the musical world, which they believe to be true. But there is a world, unheard by some, that is filled with stories of an unknown reality, a jazz side.
Today's episode is with another great artist, a dear friend and a longtime friend, cellist, composer, arranger, educator, Garfield Moore. So hello, Mr. Moore, and thank you for being a guest on the show.
Well, Miss Nunn, it is entirely my pleasure and privilege. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, this is great. I, as well as thousands of others, have had the immense privilege to experience your unique artistry. You know, like your command of the cello, your selections of materials, the arrangements of those materials, and really the deep emotional connection we as an audience get to participate in when we're listening to you perform. So I wanted to start with the instrument, okay? Over the years, I found that many artists don't normally start with instruments that they make a living playing. You know, they end up playing something else before they make a living with it. And since you were considered a child prodigy at 13, was that the first instrument that you began playing or took an interest in? Or were you playing other instruments like younger than 13?
Your intuition, insights, and instincts prove to be more and more remarkable each time we talk. The cello was not my first instrument. The guitar was. And may I elaborate just a bit?
Yes, please.
Teacher,
that's what the show is about, for you to go.
Okay, all right. I got it.
Go with it.
My teacher was a fine guitarist, but she was a great cellist. And I heard her play one afternoon when she was demonstrating for a student assembly. And she played this particular piece with which I fell in love, by a very great cellist who was the only cellist at that time who was acknowledged as one of the more important composers, Luigi Boccherini. Anyway, at that point, I was 11, and I went home, and it was going to be the cello no matter what. And everybody was kind of looking a little bit askance and askew and surprised and tried to talk me out of it. Once I heard and saw it up close and held it and hugged it, that was it.
Wow. So how was that like with being considered a prodigy that young? You know, well, that must have been an interesting kind of upbringing.
I never, in the real classical traditional sense, I never did consider myself a prodigy. I am extremely flattered that you've formulated that impression and used those words. But I can say this, I did show a sense of elevated musical feeling, expression, and energy, and seemed to have real command of the stage. But it took me a little bit by storm, because what happened, I was playing in a chamber orchestra at my junior high school, which was happened to be Garfield Junior High, which is, by the way, the same place a few years later, our great lady vice president, Kamala Harris, also attended, long after I was there, of course. But anyway, after my first year there, the conductor, a lovely, lovely, fiery redhead by the name of Phyllis Magnuson, asked a local great composer, cellist, who had just retired from a famous string quartet, to write a piece. And he wrote a concerto for cello and chamber orchestra. and they asked me to play it. And that's when I was 13. So that's kind of where my bio really begins. But it was more a question of, I think, of musical inspiration and flair and shall we say, rather determined personality than it took me a while to develop the chops. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, but you are definitely a very determined person. I mean, when you set your mind to something and the intensity of your playing is like, is really great. You know, it's been written that you're, and I'm probably going to mispronounce this word, and you're so great with all words, French, Italian, whatever, but it's been written that your repertoire is vast, expansive, diverse, and eclectic. And I would definitely agree with that. I mean, it's just outstanding. I mean, you know, you'll present these unsuspecting musical genres, these moving and lyrical and varied compositions, especially during your solo performances. So my question is, what influences, people or otherwise, if any, set you on the path of such a broad range incorporation?
My mother, my father, my grandmother, my culture, my color, my individuality, and my sense of curiosity. My first great teacher, the cellist from the Gorilla Quartet, he said, you know, he said, I wish I could get you to be as adamant about practicing as you are knowing the repertoire of the instrument and what its possibilities are. And he didn't use exactly those words. I'm cleaning it up a little bit. him being the profound Lancastrian Englishman that he was. But it's always been a passion of mine, Veronica. And I really appreciate the fact that you've taken the time to gather some information about that. But the fact of the matter is the cello repertoire, when... let's say Casals's day, the great Pablo Casals's day, was coming into sunset. And don't forget, he lived for a long time. He played for Queen Victoria, Teddy Roosevelt, and John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Okay, so that to me is completely amazing. But the repertoire that he standardized by compared by today's standards was relatively small. The five sonatas of Beethoven, the two sonatas of Brahms, lots of incidental pieces, and the concerti, Dvorak, Schumann, Sasson, and Lalo for cello and orchestra. So there was more music than that, to be sure, from a different scale, from cellists of generations who had also written works for the instruments. But in terms of the real concert venue, and appropriate repertoire, Casal standardized that from, you know, Bach to Beethoven to Brahms. Well, it worked very, very, very well for many years, but there were many artists who were curious about the cello in the 20th century, and it was kind of left to Samuel Barber and Ernst Bloch with Shlomo, Barber's solo concerto and the sonata, which I play a lot. But anyway, my point is the repertoire began to expand and broaden around the time I was getting into my teen years. And I wasn't satisfied. And I was utterly determined to unearth any and every piece that I could. And the fact of the matter was there were still works by so-called great composers that had yet to be found or discovered. The first Haydn concerto comes to life really, I mean, he died in 1809, it comes to life in 1960, and its first recording is 1962. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a very, very famous story, but most of my appearances are, you know, are in the recital situation with piano. And that was where the repertoire seemed to really need expanding. And one of the things I'm really proud of was that in my the first time I was in Carnegie Hall as a soloist, there is an English Panamanian African composer, Samuel Coleridge Taylor. The most noted work now has been for years his opera Hiawatha, which got a lot of wonderful attention. I've played it. It's a great work. But he also wrote pieces for strings, pieces for winds, and solo instruments. And one of the works he wrote was a set of variations on a theme, an original theme, which he composed for cello and piano. And its first performance, not in New York, but in the recital hall at Carnegie Hall, I gave in 1993. For instance, the first New York public radio broadcast that I did, I was with a pianist, and the music of Camille Saint-Saëns. You know, many people know the Carnival of Animals, particularly the Swan, which is a beautiful cello solo, and the concerto. But there are actually two concertos, and there are three sonatas. And the first sonata had never, well, none of them had ever received any attention in this country. And I made it my business in 1993 to start playing this piece. And it happened on the same program with the Samuel Coleridge Taylor set of variations. And the program ended with the Saint-Saëns Sonata in C minor, which is a huge, grand work. And to this day, I don't understand exactly why it doesn't get its due. Also, one last point I want to make about this is that the richness of repertoire, which has been added by American Black composers and African composers from all over the world, is absolutely extraordinary. George Walker's sonata, Coleridge Taylor Perkinson's concerto, which my last teacher, the wonderful cellist Kermit Moore, premiered with the New World Symphony, I believe in Avery Fisher Hall, some 60 years ago. And there are now a number of unaccompanied works. David Baker wrote a sonata for the wonderful cellist Janos Starker. But there have been so many contributions, particularly recently, by composers of color, men and women. For instance, Florence Price, who's known for her grand orchestral works and her composition of spirituals and arrangements of spirituals, there is now an arrangement of her great derivation, Wading in the Waters, Muddy Waters, a set of variations for cello and piano, which has gotten enormously popular. And the comment I want to make about this piece is that it is so beautiful and so dramatic, I can't wait to play it. But I have to wait till the copyright becomes available.
Oh, wow. You know, I so much... you know, I want to get into a little bit later about some of the selection parts, but I also, because all of this I didn't know. I mean, we're not privy always to this kind of information about the richness of African Americans' contribution to classical music. But I also understand that your teaching style, that you expose your students to very different wide range of types of compositions, and you know, I'm not that familiar with classical work or the work world of classical, you know, where you work in, like you were talking about all these great African American composers. But is that something people normally, you know, that they do normally, like teach, like you try to teach a wide variety of music? But is that normal to teach like that? I mean, have you had obstacles or challenges with that particular method of instruction when you try to expand young people's minds?
That's a very interesting question. The only obstacles that I've had, and I want to be real, real clear about this, because the interpersonal workings of this with my students and faculty members has really been superb. But the only difficulty that I've had, honestly, would be getting a hold of some of the scores that I really want. You know, this publishing house is closed down. They no longer publish this material. Somebody else bought the rights.
Yeah.
They're not ready to publish it yet. Or people run out of money, so they're no longer printing the music. But I would say, in general, that my students have been really receptive. It doesn't happen all the time, but sometimes, and I hope this is what you want to hear, they'll come into the studio and they'll catch me playing something or waxing or, you know, emoting about something. They go, "What is that?" And I'll say, "Well, you know, excuse me. This is, you know, this is a composer that nobody knows yet, even though it's from 300 years ago. And well, can I learn it? Can I play it? Absolutely. Come on, let's start it right now." That does tend to happen. And I want to be really clear about this, because I say I haven't had any difficulty in forging repertoire or making inroads doesn't mean that there hasn't been difficulty. Okay. One of the things which is really interesting about the horizon of classical music is there is a sense of breadth and inclusivity, but out of necessity, because audiences are not growing, unfortunately. It's going exactly the opposite direction. Okay. So when I plan a program and I say that I mean to start with the high French court of dramatic dance and arioso, and end with the spiritual that I most loved to hear the magnificent Leontine Price sing, right on King Jesus, I mean what I say. And when I also say that I'm going to play works of colleagues, jazz sonata, or individual pieces that reflect some modern take on the cello, I'm going to do that. But one of the things that I try to do in programming is to leave my audience wanting more. Okay. And this is not an attitude a lot of people have. I'm not trying to make it easy on myself, but I find that something, the meat and potatoes, whatever part of the repertoire it is. But let me give you an example. I will open with I have a colleague whom I think very highly of, whom I consider to be a very dear friend, Akua Dixon. And as a graduate project, yes, she wrote a sonata in jazz style. Now, the only person who has this music in the country right now is me, okay? That's a big secret, okay, not to be told. But wow. I have championed this work whenever I get the chance. And I played it as recently as January at the Orr Gallery, which was really kind of officially my debut here on the Gulf Coast. And it was fantastic. It's a museum built in pods, five pods, and each pod has a different purpose. And the main pod was where they held the performance. And I'm pleased to report that not only were the acoustics beautiful, but the space was filled. They had to turn away 100 people. And wow. On that program, I did have the privilege of playing, you know, there was no intermission. So it was the French work. Interestingly enough, a Ukrainian work that nobody knows. The first great, pardon me for the way I'm mushing this together. And what I'm about to say, any cultural faux pas. But the first great Russian cellist was really an Ukrainian by the name of Ilya Lisogyu. And he was a composer who at his best was almost an equal of Franz Schubert. And this little sonata that he wrote in three movements is really a beautiful mini opera. It's the most lyrical, engaging thing that you can imagine. Well, no one knows it. But I felt that in celebrating in January this event, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., that playing a piece from a Ukrainian was a particularly moving thing to do, because I'm sure that Dr. King would have stood in solidarity with the quest of these people for freedom, whatever the politics and the other stuff is aside. So on this program, I had the French high French court music. I had Madame Dixon's jazz sonata in one movement, and I had the Ukrainian piece, and I play a version of the sonata that Dvorak wrote when he came to this country before he took over the Institute, which later became the Juilliard School. Now, this fiddle sonata has everything in it from what we would today refer to respectfully a Native American lament, gorgeous slow movement, to a Hoppin' John, Black Eyed Pea dance on themes of Little Liza Jane. Seriously. And this was what was so close to Antonin Dvorak's heart and what he loved about being here. So even though it was written for violin, the fact that it lays so well on the cello, and I have never played this work where people haven't, it hasn't ended up with people on their feet with the biggest smiles. We said, I've never heard that piece. Where did you find it? You know, now many violinists know about it. It has become more popular, but I want to complete my original point is the classical genre has become inclusive out of necessity. Now, that's a good enough reason for me, okay? But you're hearing works on the radio by Florence Price. You're hearing the wonderful English African cellist Sekou Kenault-Maison. I occasionally, you know, have appearances, which I really enjoy. But my point is, I want to say, I know I've said it three times before, I need to say it again. Out of necessity, we are becoming inclusive. Because without everybody in the audience, concert sales are going to dry up. And there it is.
Okay. That's actually interesting that you say that, because, you know, in looking at what you had mentioned, Carnegie Hall and other places, but you know, you've paid your dues, you know, you put in a lot of gig time, as they say, you know, and I mean, it's like you've have served as principal cellist for the Pacific Philharmonic, Santa Cruz Symphony, Alvin Ailey Ballet, which I thought was probably really remarkable, Opera Ebony, Universal Chamber Orchestra, West End Symphony, Musical Heritage Concert Society. You also have appeared as a guest soloist for the New York Festival of Voices, and you did like a residency at SUNY Ulster, an artist in residency. So, you know, jazz musicians, for instance, and you brought this up, that's just out of necessity, you know, jazz musicians, for instance, will perform and record their originals and also songs that are considered like, you know, jazz standards. And then there are some standards that, you know, like if I have to hear Autumn Leaves like one more time being recorded, you know, it's just like, why? Mm-hmm. But circling back, you know, just going back to all of those performances that I mentioned you played, and you actually answered this question, because I was going to ask, have you found the classical audience open to more of these obscure pieces, you know,
absolutely,
considering, you know, that from the very beginning, your work, you were playing a lot of unknown works while you were performing. Mm-hmm. So you said out of necessity. So they are much more open to that, even though,
absolutely.
Like, so when you're doing something, do you stick in like, you know, some of your original things inside of all of that as well, you know, like when you're planning a set list, so to speak.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what it is, a set list. Yes, yeah. And when we say my stuff, it might be a flourish, it might be a cadenza, it might be a change, a voicing, or, you know, but yeah, I am involved, certainly involved, at least slightly on the creative end. But may I address something that you mentioned, because you talked about gigging. And I want to let everybody know, I had the privilege, I have always considered being able to make a living as a cellist, as an artist, and a teacher, a privilege and a responsibility. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that I have succeeded in every situation. I have not, okay? I've succeeded in most situations, but I have always been enormously grateful for the opportunity to have a chance and to certainly be able to make a living. And that happened to me largely through the Broadway Theater and the recording studio in San Francisco and in New York. And let me just say it that way. But I'd also like to say the first time that I managed to get in Carnegie Hall was because of another very great lady like yourself, unfortunately, who's no longer with us, the divine Sarah Vaughan. And that was the first time I stepped into Carnegie Hall, was as a side man behind her. And of course, not of course, we should say, as stunning and regal and magically musical as she was, the great Sarah Vaughan suffered from a tremendous case of nerves, okay? Which is something certainly, well, at least I'll say I'm no stranger to. But my point is this. It was the Cool Jazz Festival in July. First time I'm in Carnegie Hall. And to my right of the risers, I'm on the end, you know, the young cellist. Billy Eckstein is there for moral support. And the divine Sarah is out in front. And when I tell you that the Send in the Clowns, there are only two times I've had this feeling. The like you, she had an incomparable range. And there was something that could happen at the top of the voice when she got in the zone, which was simply, I'm going to say it this way. I'm going to be myself. I'm going to be weird. It was nearly as beautiful. It was as beautiful as the magnificent Leontine Price in the great fourth act of Verdi's Trovatore. And my point in bringing this up is not to drop names or to try to sound impressive, but to say that the musical spirit, the inspiration, has no classification. It simply has truth, beauty, and greatness, or it doesn't. And I found it everywhere. Mm. In the recording studio, in the recording session, in the orchestra pit, of the Broadway show, in the opera pit, and certainly, once again, with the divine Sarah Vaughan in Carnegie Hall. So out of necessity and reason, and I think it's proven to be reasonable, I have not seen divisions. I've seen some closed doors. I've had a few of them shut in my face. But sooner or later, they open. Mm-hmm. And I have found that persistence, sincerity, integrity, and determination are always key.
Wow. Yeah. That's incredible, because I'm not that in the work world of classical music, you know, like where you're actually working and putting the things together. And I was always curious about how other artists thought, like some artists think in just really kind of a tunnel when it comes to their music and the type of thing that is there. Like there are some traditionalists with jazz. It's just traditional music. They feel if you have to play this and that's it. And avant-garde or anything that's bebop is outside of that. And I was kind of wondering if the classical world was like that. But in looking at your career and looking at the choices you made and the diversity of the stages and opportunities you've had to perform, it has really been very different for you. And I think that's also a personal thing, an openness in your on your part, you know, a non-rigidity, you know. That says, as you said earlier, the respect for the depth of art itself, you know, and the value of that. And that's like very, very moving. And I wanted to ask you, I saw something, and I couldn't find a lot on it, but it's about it said something that you are a founding partner of Trilogy. What is Trilogy? Is that?
Oh, that's excellent question.
Could you just kind of give me some? Yeah.
Yeah, excellent question. excellent question. Trilogy was a piano trio, piano, violin, and cello, and which is a standard form in classical repertoire. But I have two very dear colleagues who are enormously talented, both of whom I worked with from an early time on in New York. And my goodness, Richard Gordon is one of the finest pianists I've ever known. And Kathy Kinky was a grand soloist and is a really, really fine musician. And we don't have the opportunity to play together anymore, but we're still very much in touch and very fond. So Trilogy was kind of a play on words, was a trio.
Interesting. That's just like, little things you find and you want to know, like, what is that? So
yeah, what is he talking
about?
So
now,
exactly.
Are you ready? Yeah, well, I mean, I saw it and I was wondering it because, I couldn't find a lot of information on the web about it. So that's why I said, well, I'm just going to pull out and just ask him about that, But that's That's great to know. Did you guys?
We played some concerts that got recorded between, honestly, 1999 and 2007. So it wasn't.
Okay, because I was just getting ready to ask you if you recorded. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, there is one recording. There is one live recording. Yes.
Okay, so it's live. Do you like doing live recordings? Better than studio?
Yes, because it's honest and it's. But I'm not the person to judge. My manager and recording expert and videographer. I mean, he has pure hell dealing with me, because one note goes like, nope, that's it. But the truth is, generally, with most artists, there's so much more in the live performance. Now, there are some exceptions to that, but my preference is for the live recording. But that means I have to keep practicing and keep getting better, And it's still at the ripe old age of 71. It's a challenge. It's a real challenge. That's all I can tell you.
Oh, okay. Well, are you ready to walk down into the basement with me? That's a metaphor for the subconscious. Are you ready?
Absolutely.
That part of the show where we go.
Absolutely.
All right. So here's the first question. Okay, get a sip of water, breathe, clear our throats. Okay, so what is the scariest subject in any medium? Like that would be either painting, photographs, books, movies, television show, radio broadcast, dreams, real life, outside of music, whatever that you've encountered.
Shaking and stage fright. And that's all I have to say about it.
All right.
No, I'm teasing.
Okay,
I actually
no problem.
Have quite a bit to say. Yeah. Can I be open about this?
Yes, please. That's why I'm asking, because it's a deep.
Deep thank you. Thank you. I didn't want to go on ad infinitum. But I remember a title of a great novel, The Agony and the Ecstasy. And for me, it's kind of been the ecstasy and the agony. And it is always, for me, a tremendous responsibility. A tremendous responsibility when I bring music to the public and I sit down to perform. I take it very seriously. And I have not always had, but in adult life, certainly, I have had some real demons. And what it took me years to figure out was that dealing with the demons and eventually slaying as many of the dragon demons as possible made me a better artist. And I didn't die. I didn't end up in the booby hatch. I didn't lose my apartment. You know, everything was okay. As a matter of fact, today, and I have a real belief about challenging these things. And like I say, may I speak quite candidly? And I'm mentioning this.
Yeah,
with
please,
pride.
Please.
In my family history, there is a history of mental instability and some real challenges. Now, I want to remind you that my father was a great surgeon and my mother was a fine professor in whose name there is still a full scholarship at the State University in Sonoma. Okay, so we're talking about highly functional folks. However, when the doors were closed and things got real, got different, it was awkward. So I come by whatever this
got real
indisposition is, quite honestly. But fear and anxiety have always been with me in my career. But rather than see them any longer as the enemy, I see them as the forces. We have a term in Buddhism, as you will know, Shoten Zenjin, that keep me on track. And I also have come to understand that over the years that, you know, this is part of the admission. Yeah, you don't have enough money to pay the rent. You have to get out there, play the concert. You might not make enough money. Why do you keep doing it? It's simple. Because I love it and I couldn't do. I have done other things and I've loved other things, you know, but I simply love it. And one of the things that I want to say, I say this to students and colleagues alike, where there is a will, there's a way. And one quick story. You asked me what I'm scared of. Well, I hadn't appeared as a soloist in front of an orchestra as a soloist for 15 years at that point. Okay. This is 1988. And I played 1989, excuse me. I played a recital down in Houston and a conductor was there and he said, well, how do you do, Mr. Moore? I've so enjoyed your recital. He said, I am James Barkwell and I conduct the Brazosport Philharmonic. I said, good. Would you like to have me come play a concerto with the orchestra? And I don't know where that came from. Okay, I was not thinking that. It just came out.
Wow.
Anyway, he said yes. And a year later, when the concert came around, I was getting on the plane with the ticket. We were on rent strike. I didn't have two nickels rubbed together. And I really hadn't performed as that sort of soloist in quite a while. And I was really scared. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I spent a lot of sleepless nights. But after the sixth curtain call, I figured, okay, it must be all right. And I went home,
still on rent strike,
no money. Okay, broke. But I have a very important point that I want to make. When you demonstrate to the universe or those forces around you, whatever your belief is, that you're really giving your all and you're committed to it, something will click, something will happen. I come home with 102 fever. I'm on my floor on the futon, on the mat. Can't pay the rent, and I don't give a damn because the concert has gone well. I've satisfied my artist and my audience. Okay, now hear me now. And I still got one of them old modular phones, and I just fall asleep, and it starts ringing. Now, I've not got two nickels to rub together. Okay, can't pay the rent. Garfield Moore, this is Joe Melman. Yo, we know you're just back from Texas, but we're the Rat Pack is out here in L.A. and we need another chalice. Can you meet us in Chicago? It pays $5,000 and I'll get your hotel set up and you can spend a day there before we get there. He said, can you do it? And I said, is a frog's ass watertight? Okay, anyway, I went from flat broke, 102 fever, 2 days later, mm-hmm. I'm at the Ambassador mm-hmm. Hotel East. Chicago is my family home. My first trip there, meeting the Rat Pack. Mm-hmm. I'm walking up the back of the stairs, the Chicago Hotel, and I stairs, and there is Dean Martin at 72, looking just like himself, one of the friendliest people I've ever met. And between he and Sammy Davis and Mr. Sinatra, it was quite a way to unwind, dispel some fear, regroup the finances that I had lost, and come away with the understanding, one, you're doing the right thing, and number two, there will be a way. Mm-hmm. So keep putting one foot in front of the other.
Wow. Wow. That's a great story. That's an excellent story.
It's true.
Because that's, you know, I met you through, I met you through Nietzsche and Buddhism. That's actually how we met. So I do feel strongly and support those kind of principles and the ways we look at life. So now we're going to look at the second question, which is, tell us about someone you have worked with who was a little frightening to you, but in a good way, because we're not going to do any slandering.
I would have to say, I want to make absolutely certain that I choose the situation which can best illustrate or bring forth the point that you want me to make. And the truth of the matter is that I would have to say Yul Brynner. Okay.
Wow. I did not expect that.
I got to play. Well, I'm making this choice for a reason, because this speaks to the centrality of what went on in my career. Okay. And he was revered mm-hmm. as the most serious of artists who had ever walked across the Broadway stage. And what happened, it was his last run of The King and I. It was 1985. Well, I got on the gig because the recording industry was shifting, and lots of people who had been in the recording industry, in my teacher, Kermit Moore, of course, was certainly one of the kingpins, were now doing other sorts of commercial work. And they offered him a fabulous sum to play principal cello. And he wanted me on the gig because I was his student then, had just had eye surgery. And in addition to the fact that I would be cooperative and competent, he knew how much I cared about him. Kermit Moore was like a second father to mm-hmm. me, let me be clear. Okay. Wonderful cellist, wonderful, wonderful composer, genius. So we are at this first rehearsal, and Yul comes downstairs to rehearse with us. And I'm turning pages, of course, for Kermit, and we're playing the part, and everything's going, oh, well, there aren't too many solos. Okay, that's not too difficult. Kermit is playing very well. Well, again, I want to mention that Kermit wanted me on the gig with him because he just had this eye surgery. And he literally could not see unless something was very clear or he had a special pair of glasses. Well, unbeknownst to us, something wonderful, the final big song had gone from a violin solo to a cello solo. So we're sitting there all stretched out and relaxed, and I turn the page, and there's this chicken scratch on this piece of manuscript paper, and the ink isn't even dry. And I mean, it's not been put through any process. It's just handwritten.
Okay.
And Kermit started to play, and I saw the look of panic go over his eyes because he couldn't see. And I waved my hand and I said, you can't give this to such a distinguished artist. I shall play now for you. I was scared to death, but I was protecting my father, my family. And all I remember is that 26 people were on their feet applauding when I got through. And I looked over at Kermit and he went, bravo. And my point is that it was one of the scariest moments of my life, but also singularly the most meaningful, the happiest, and it was like getting to the top of the mountain and waving a red flag. I hope that's, you know,
So working with your mentor Kermit and having to step in like that and to be there because Yul Brynner. I mean, did Yul Brynner say anything? Did he know that it was anything different? Because
he smiled. No, he didn't know.
So that was scary because of the fact that you had to do this impromptu from the chicken scratch and everything like that. That kind of falls into the third question that I was going to ask you, which is, what is the scariest thing that has ever happened to you while performing live?
Okay, I'm going to take a real risk here because I have never talked about this publicly before. The scariest thing that ever happened to me actually happened some years before. I was in college and I was playing principal cello with the conductor. I was the only person of color in the orchestra, and I don't want to throw that up as a defense. I just want to say the conductor and I had a real love-hate relationship. And, you know, it came first time. There was some little concertant part, some little something. Anyway, I had been using a cello that the university owned, and it was in a heavy solid oak case. And I never should have carried that oak case. And I got there, and the concert, and I said, well, after I play this well, you know, he'll be on my side. Well, I didn't play well. I started to shake and tremble. And I never had that experience. And I honestly felt that I had invented some new form of psychosis, neurosis. And I felt that this was proof that I didn't belong on stage. And it was singularly the most painful moment of my life. Now, you know what I do when that thought occurs to me? He's dead. I'm not. I'm going to have a drink and not worry about it. But the reason that I bring that up is that there is no career, major or minor, which is without the hurdles of challenges, setbacks, anxiety, depression, and pain. It's part of the plan so that we can bring forth our humanity and express things. Now, that I still, in the back of my mind, occasionally carry that fear with me. But a lot of times when I think about it, oh, come on, that was 50 years ago, and I laugh about it, you know? Mm-hmm. And it really did produce a moment in my life of uncertainty, of deep doubt and anxiety, and took me a while to get through it, but I did get through it.
Do you remember the piece you were playing when that started?
Yes, I do. It was the last movement of a Haydn symphony. I can tell you the key. The key was F major. And fortunately, I've never run into it again. But,
I was wondering if you ever played it again.
Oh, hell no. No, 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 no. Not that I wouldn't, you understand. Not that I wouldn't. But everybody at some point or other, and I want to make this point, okay? And one of the things that has been of really moving and meaningful to me is that the confidence that I'm able to inculcate in my students is just, I'm like, where did she learn that? Where did he learn that? How did that happen? And they'll always turn around and say, you taught me. You know, so that's that. I've never spoken about that before, but that's what happened.
Well, that's wonderful, because that's our deep dive right there into like some of the three questions that I always ask artists, because I think, as you're saying, each scenario, each experience as an artist and us doing our artistic thing, you know, we're going to have challenges and obstacles and hurdles and things like that. And, mm-hmm. you know, your sharing your story is really great because it gives people a sense that, okay, I'm not by myself with this. You know,
exactly.
I'm dealing with certain things and actually, you know, wow, I somebody who has had the vast experience that you've had and played all these different types of gigs and performances and all capacity. And you and I have talked about a whole lot of other things, but we only have so much time on the show. So maybe another time we come back and I can get you to delve even deeper into some of the incredible work that you've done with just in your lifetime and being an African American in the classical world. So I want to thank you so much for doing the show. I mean, this has been so great. I think it's going to help so many people and just even what they choose as artists to perform with. And I had a really great time. I had a really, really great time. So I really appreciate you doing this. And you're wonderful as always. Mm-hmm. And
well, allow me to assure you that as great a time as you had, you didn't have nigh about as good a time as I did. And it is I, madame, who must thank you. Thank you so much, Veronica.
You're welcome, Mr. Moore. And that wraps it up for us on Tales from the Jazz Side.
The Jazz Side is always there, waiting for us to enter and waiting to enter us. So, until next time, unplug your ear holes, for you never know what worlds may be waiting for you.